You know that feeling when everything looks perfect on paper? You're hitting all your numbers at work, your Fitbit says you slept 7 hours, your bank account is technically in the green, but you just feel brittle.
Like you're made of glass.
Exactly, like you're made of glass. Like if one tiny thing goes wrong,
right,
a flat tire, a snarky email from your boss, a sudden expense, the whole house of cards just completely collapses.
That is a very common, very modern sensation. And we have a name for it in the systems world, actually.
Oh, you do?
We do. It's called high flow, low viability.
High flow, low viability. That sounds, I don't know, it sounds like a medical diagnosis.
It sort of is. And it's not just a diagnosis for people. It's for companies, for economies, even for biological cells. We are, as a culture, obsessed with the flow.
The output.
The output, the speed, the GDP, the heart rate, all the metrics.
Yeah.
But we completely, totally ignore the structure that's holding it all up.
And that is exactly why we are here today. We're doing a deep dive into a text that, and I'm not exaggerating here, it blew my mind a little bit.
It's a heavy one.
It's a heavy one. It's called The Unifying Grammar of Viability, Constraint, Memory, and the Preservation of Connected Futures. It's by Dr. Bechara Sehaly and an AI research partner.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have to be honest with you. When I first saw that title, I thought, okay, this is going to be some dense academic word salad.
And it is dense. I won't lie about that. It's what we'd call a minimal metaphysics.
Which usually sends me running for the hills. But that's the thing. Once you crack it open, it's not really about philosophy in the, you know, toga wearing what is a chair sense. It's a survival guide.
That's the best way to put it. It's a handbook for how to keep going without falling apart. And its claim is that it applies to everything. It tries to answer the question, why do supposedly efficient systems collapse?
Right.
Why does a star athlete who's at the peak of their game suddenly burn out? Why does a booming economy with record growth suddenly just crash?
And the answer isn't just bad luck or a black swan event.
No. The answer, according to this text, is geometry.
Okay, you've hooked me. Geometry. I'm thinking back to high school math, and I'm a little scared, but I'm in. So usually in these deep dives, we start by looking at the content of a problem, you know, the specific events, the who did what. But Dr. Sehaly wants us to look at the topology.
Exactly. Think of it this way. Most of us live our lives looking at the dashboard of a car. We're watching the speedometer, the fuel gauge, the RPMs. That's the content of your driving. That's the flow.
So how fast am I going? How much fuel do I have left?
Right. But this text says, stop looking at the dashboard. Look at the road.
The road itself.
The road itself. Is the road a flat, 8-lane highway? It's bumpy. Or are you, without realizing it, driving on a razor-thin mountain ridge with a 1,000-foot drop on both sides?
And if you're on that ridge, it doesn't matter that your speedometer says you're going 100 miles an hour. If you just twitch the wheel, you're gone.
Precisely. You can have a high-flow speedometer reading while driving on a low-viability road. And that is the central paradox the text is built on. Collapse almost never happens because the engine stops. It happens because the road narrowed and you didn't even notice.
That is genuinely terrifying, but it also makes so much sense. So the mission for this deep dive is to map that road, to understand this grammar of viability. And the text starts with some very hard rules. The physics of existence.
Axiom one. The rules of the game.
Sounds ominous.
It is, because it's completely non-negotiable. Whether you're a single bacterium or a Fortune 500 company or an entire civilization, you operate under two unshakable conditions. The first one is pretty obvious. Finite resources.
Okay, fair enough. We run out of gas. We run out of money. Our bodies run out of energy. That's standard economics, standard biology.
Right. But the second one is the real kicker. Irreversible time.
Now, hold on a second. We live in a world of undo buttons. We have backspaces on our keyboards. We can apologize and fix things. Is time really irreversible?
In a thermodynamic sense, yes. Absolutely, 100%. You cannot unburn a log.
Right.
You cannot uneat a meal. And in a complex system, you cannot perfectly undo a decision. If you break trust with a client, you can apologize. You can maybe fix the relationship, but you can't restore the system to the exact state it was in a second before the break. The history is now written into the structure of that relationship.
So we aren't playing a video game where you can just reload your last save file if you make a mistake.
There are no save files. There are no do-overs. Everything you do, every single action, changes the playing field forever. And these two constraints, finite resources and irreversible time, they create what the text calls the viability set, or simply dollars.
The magic letter.
Think of dollars as the sandbox of survival. Imagine a vast, dark, infinite ocean. That ocean is the universe of all possible states. chaos, death, disintegration, non-existence. Dollars is the little island in the middle of that ocean where you can actually exist. It's the set of boundary conditions where your heart can beat, where your company remains solvent, where your democracy continues to function. It's the safe space.
So inside the boundary, you're in the game. You're viable outside the boundary.
Game over. Irreversible failure. Death. Bankruptcy. Collapse. The end.
It's binary. There's no middle ground.
It is absolutely binary. You are either viable or you are not. There is no sort of alive in this framework. And this is where the text brings us to the math. And I know listeners sometimes get nervous when we bring up equations.
I get nervous when we bring up equations.
But this isn't, you know, quantum mechanics. It's a budget. It's what the author calls the arithmetic of survival. And it's an inequality, which is actually more intuitive than an equation.
An inequality. Okay, I've got it written down here in my notes. It's replenishment on one side and then demand plus disturbance, all dolls on the other.
Exactly. But let's not even think of it as algebra. Let's just think of it as a tank of gas. That's the easiest metaphor.
I like gas tanks. I can visualize that.
Perfect. So replenishment is the fuel you're putting into the tank. It's food, it's revenue, it's sleep, it's emotional support from your friends. It's all the energy coming into the system.
Got it. The input.
Then you have demand. This is the baseline cost of just existing. It's the cost of idling the engine. For a human, it's your resting metabolism. For a company, it's your fixed costs, rent, payroll. Even if you do absolutely nothing, you are burning dollars every second just to stay in the game.
That's the overhead, the cost of keeping the lights on.
Precisely. But then, and this is the variable that everyone forgets, the one that causes all the trouble, there is $6. The disturbance.
The chaos factor.
That's a good way to put it. It's the unexpected traffic jam, the sudden storm, the viral infection that leaves you out for a week, the lawsuit that comes out of nowhere. $6 is the randomness of the universe hitting your windshield at high speed.
So the whole game, the entire arithmetic of survival, is basically asking, is what's coming in greater than or equal to what's going out just to exist, plus what's needed to fight off all the random chaos?
That's it. That is the golden rule. Dryl T plus XO. If you consistently satisfy that inequality, you are safe. In fact, if your trialers is consistently bigger than a dollars plus XO, you start to build up a buffer. The text gives this buffer a name, margin.
Margin. I love that word. It just sounds like a deep, relaxing breath.
It is. Margin is the distance between you and the cliff edge. If you have high margin, you can take a hit. You can get the flu or lose a major client or face a political scandal, and you're still okay. You're still inside the boundary. You're still on the island of dollars.
But if your margin is zero,
you are towing the edge of the cliff every single day. One gust of wind, one tiny unexpected $6, and you fall. But here is where the text gets really profound and moves beyond simple budgeting. We usually stop the analysis right there. We look at our bank account or our energy levels and we say, okay, I have enough for today.
I can make it through the week if I'm careful.
Right. Yeah. But we are ignoring the other side of the ledger. We are ignoring a hidden variable the authors call entrenchment or dollar-aller.
Entrenchment. Okay, this feels like the villain of the story.
It's the silent killer. It really is.
Yeah.
Imagine you are hiking up a mountain. Your margin is how much water you have left in your bottle. That's your immediate resource.
Easy enough.
But entrenchment is the weight of your backpack.
Oh, that's a really good distinction.
Entrenchment represents the cost of history. It's the accumulated damage, the scar tissue, the technical debt, the financial debt, the structural rigidities that you've picked up along the way.
So wait, give me a concrete example of that. Let's make it real.
Okay, let's take a business. Two companies, mm-hmm. both have exactly $100,000 in the bank today. On paper, their margin looks identical.
Same snapshot.
Same snapshot. But Company A is debt-free, has a great reputation, and has a flexible, innovative team. Company B has a massive high-interest loan, a warehouse full of unsold inventory that's about to rot, and a toxic work culture. Company B has incredibly high entrenchment.
So even though their cash flow at this exact moment looks the same, their actual reality, their future possibilities are totally different.
Totally different. Because Company B has to spend a huge chunk of its incoming energy, its $3, just servicing its history. It has to pay the interest on the loan. It has to deal with the rotting inventory. Its viability potential, that's the term the text uses, 50 depliters, is much, much lower.
It's like two people trying to run a marathon. They're running at the exact same speed, but one of them is secretly wearing a 50-pound vest.
Yes. And here's the really scary part about entrenchment. It usually comes from the very act of surviving past crises.
What do you mean by that? How can survival be bad?
Well, think about it. You're short on cash for your business. Your dollars is too low, so you take out a high-interest loan to make payroll. That loan saves you today. It keeps you inside the boundary. It keeps you on the island. But now, you have debt. You have just increased your entrenchment. You survived the battle, but you've added permanent weight to your backpack for all future battles.
Or physically. Let's say I injure my knee while I'm training for that marathon. I keep running because I have to hit my goal, but I change my gait, my form, to compensate for the pain. I survived the run, but now my hip is twisted out of alignment. I've entrenched a limp into my body's structure.
Exactly. That is structural deformation.
Yeah.
You're trading future flexibility for present survival.
Yeah.
It's a deal with the devil, in a way. In the formula the text gives, and don't worry, I won't make you solve it. Exodus says this: your true safety, your viability potential, isn't just your margin. It's your margin minus your entrenchment with a little weighting factor in there.
So basically, phi equals mb boy 2, which means if your entrenchment, your backpack, is heavy enough, you can have money in the bank and still be mathematically doomed.
You can be a walking ghost. You can be, in the text's words, structurally rotten.
Mm-hmm.
You feel fine, your flow is high, your dashboard looks great, but your underlying topology is so fragile, so constrained, that the slightest breeze will shatter you.
Structurally rotten. That is a phrase that's going to stick with me. And this seems to transition us, not just mathematically, but visually, into the second big idea of the text. We're moving from the arithmetic of the budget to the geometry of the landscape.
This is where we have to really retrain our brains.
Yeah.
Because as humans, we are terrible at geometry. We are what the text calls linear thinkers.
Linear meaning what goes in is what comes out, a straight line.
We think in straight lines, yes.
Yeah.
We have this deep-seated assumption that if I push a system a little bit, it will react a little bit. If I work one extra hour, I get one extra hour's worth of tired.
Mm.
If I eat one extra donut, I gain one extra ounce. We assume the world operates on a flat, predictable slope.
But it doesn't.
Not at all. Living systems are fundamentally nonlinear. The boundary of that island, dollars, isn't a straight line you cross. It's a curve. Specifically, it's convex.
Convexity. Okay, break that down for me. Why should I care if my life's boundary is convex?
You should care deeply, because convexity means that the further you go into debt, whether it's biological debt, financial debt, emotional debt, the steeper the hill back to safety gets.
So the backpack doesn't just get heavier, it gets exponentially heavier.
Or you could think of it as the gravity of your situation getting stronger. Imagine you are walking up a gentle hill. That's the early stage of stress, of taking on entrenchment. You can push through it. But as you keep pushing, as that entrenchment grows and grows, the hill suddenly turns into a vertical wall. The cost to take just one more step skyrockets.
This is why the last hour of an all-nighter hurts 10 times more than the first hour. It's not a linear decline.
It's not linear at all. The cost accelerates. And this acceleration leads to what I think is the most important and maybe most terrifying concept in this entire document, the saddle node bifurcation.
Now that sounds like something out of Star Trek. Captain, the ship's approaching a saddle node bifurcation.
It does. But it's actually a core term from dynamical systems theory, and it explains why things don't just bend, they snap.
Snap, as in a total breakdown.
As in sudden, catastrophic, non-recoverable change. We tend to think that if we get into trouble, we can just turn around and walk back the way we came.
Yeah.
But a bifurcation means the road behind you literally disappears.
Give me a visual. How do I picture a bifurcation in the real world?
Okay. Imagine you are sitting in a chair. You're leaning back on just the two back legs.
I do this all the time. My mother hates it.
Your mother is right, because she intuitively understands bifurcation theory.
Mm-hmm.
So you're leaning back. You're balancing. You're in what we call a stable state. You can rock a little bit forward, a little bit back, and the chair just settles back into its balanced position.
Right. I'm in the zone. I'm safe.
Now imagine you lean back just one more millimeter, just a tiny bit too far.
I fall instantly.
But look at the physics of what just happened. It's not that you slid into a new, less comfortable position. It's that the balancing state itself ceased to exist. The physics of the system changed in an instant. There is no longer a place for you to be upright and balanced. The only available state is on the floor.
The valley, the safe spot where I was balancing, it just vanished. It's gone.
It was annihilated.
Yeah.
That is a saddle node bifurcation. As stress rises, as you lean further and further back, the safe state, balancing, and the dangerous unstable state, the tipping point, move closer and closer together in state space. And then, pop, they collide and cancel each other out. The system must collapse into the next available state.
This has to be why you hear about people who are, you know, high-functioning alcoholics or workaholics for 20 years. They seem fine, and then one Tuesday morning, they just can't get out of bed. It's over.
Yes. They didn't just have a bad day. Their entire internal topology shifted. They hit the bifurcation point. The valley of high-functioning disappeared from their personal map.
Is there a warning sign? Because if I'm balancing on that chair, I really want to know before I hit the floor, is there any way to see it coming?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And the text says, yes, there is a clear, measurable warning signal. It's a phenomenon called critical slowing down.
Critical slowing down. Okay. What does that look like in real life?
It looks like a wobble.
A wobble.
Think about a spinning top. When it's spinning fast, when it's highly stable and has a lot of energy, if you flick it with your finger, what happens?
It rights itself almost instantly. It's tight, it's resilient.
Exactly. But as it loses energy, as it gets closer and closer to falling over, what happens when you flick it then?
It wobbles all over the place. It takes a long time to get back to center, if it ever does. It swings really wide.
That is critical slowing down. It's the dramatic increase in recovery time from small shocks. In your life, it could be. You get into a minor argument with your partner. Do you both bounce back in 10 minutes? Or does it derail the entire weekend?
Ooh, that hits home.
Yeah. If it ruins the whole weekend, that is a geometric warning sign. It means your basin of attraction, your valley of stability is getting dangerously shallow. You are losing the restoring force that pulls you back to equilibrium.
So increased variance, bigger mood swings, more market volatility in finance, wild energy crashes in the afternoon. These aren't just symptoms to be managed. They are structural red flags.
They are the sirens screaming that a bifurcation is getting close.
Man, okay. So we have this landscape. We have these valleys, which are the safe places to be. We have ridges, which are the tipping points. But the text also talks about a folded landscape, which I take to imply there can be multiple valleys.
Yes. And this is where it gets really tricky for us psychologically. We have this bias where we assume there's one healthy state and one dead state. But in most complex systems, there are lots of intermediate states, suboptimal basins.
A suboptimal basin? Okay. That sounds like being stuck in a dead-end job you hate.
That is the perfect example. You aren't dead. You're not unemployed and starving. But you certainly aren't thriving. You're not growing. You're not fulfilled. You're stuck at a dip in the landscape. And here is the profound cruelty of the folded landscape. You can't just walk out of it.
Because there are ridges all around me. It would be harder to leave than to stay.
Exactly. To leave that bad job, you might have to take a pay cut for a while, or go back to school at night, or risk the uncertainty of starting your own thing. That's a ridge. You have to climb up. You have to spend a massive amount of extra energy just to get out of the hole you're in.
And this is the concept of hysteresis, right? Path dependence.
Seriousness, yes.
Yeah.
It means the path out is not the same as the path in. Getting into that dead-end job was probably easy, a gradual slide. Getting out is a hard, steep climb.
I feel like we really need to drill down on this because so many people, myself included, think, oh, if I just stop the stressor, I'll be fine. I'll just go back to normal.
Right. If I just stop overspending, I'll be out of debt. No. Stopping the overspending just stops you from digging the hole deeper. You are still standing at the bottom of the hole.
You're still in that suboptimal basin.
And to get out, you need a ladder.
Mm.
You need a massive surge of surplus energy. The text has a phrase for this that I absolutely love. Recovery demands overshoot.
Recovery demands overshoot. Say more about that.
You cannot heal by just breaking even. If you are burned out from overwork, just going back to a normal 40-hour week won't fix it. You are still in an energy deficit.
Yeah.
You need extra rest. Massive amounts of it. If an economy is in a deep depression, just balancing the budget won't fix it. You need a surplus. You need to flood the system with enough energy to push it up and over the ridge back into the healthy, thriving basin.
That is such a powerful rebuttal to the entire modern efficiency mindset. We're told constantly to be lean, to be efficient, to never have excess. But this framework says excess is the only way to heal.
Excess is the medicine. Efficiency is what keeps you trapped in the hole. It's optimized for a stable world, but it leaves you with no resources to change your state when you need to.
Wow. Okay. I need to process that. Efficiency keeps you trapped.
Oh.
Well, I'm chewing on that. Let's move to section three. Because this is where the text takes these abstract physics concepts and applies them directly to our minds, to our sense of self.
This is the section on memory, trauma, and the self, and it's a game changer.
Now, usually when we talk about memory, we think of it like a filing cabinet in our brain. I remember my third grade teacher's name. I remember what I had for breakfast. It's information retrieval.
That's what we could call informational memory. But the text is much more interested in structural memory.
Structural memory.
Think about a piece of paper. If you crumple it up into a tight ball and then you try to flatten it out again, is it the same piece of paper it was before?
No, of course not. It's got creases all over it. The texture is completely different. It will never be perfectly flat again.
That is structural memory. The paper remembers the crumpling, not by writing down "I was crumpled," but by physically changing its shape. Its entire topology has drifted.
So our history, our entrenchment, is basically the collection of creases in the paper of our lives.
Yes. And those creases and folds determine where the marble can roll. If there's a deep, well-worn crease, the marble, which represents your attention, your behavior will naturally fall into it over and over again.
And this leads directly to Dr. Salehli's definition of trauma, which is, I mean, I've read a lot in psychology, but I have never seen it defined quite like this. It's so physical.
It's a rigorous geometric definition, and it's incredibly powerful. He argues that trauma is not the bad event, the car accident, the war, the abuse. That is the disturbance. That's the impact.
Okay. So if that's not the trauma, what is?
Trauma is the persistent narrowing of reachable future space.
The persistent narrowing of reachable future space. Okay, let's unpack that slowly.
Imagine that landscape again. A healthy, non-traumatized person is standing on a hill, and they can see a 360-degree view of options. I can go here. I can try that. I can trust this new person. I can apply for that job. I can explore this new hobby.
They have a wide horizon, lots of possibilities.
Exactly. Now imagine a huge impact, a massive disturbance hits that landscape. It doesn't just shake it. It craters it. It digs a deep, narrow trench, and you fall into it.
And I'm safe down in the trench, away from the danger.
You are safe. That is the crucial point. The trench is a defensive basin. In neurobiology, this might be hypervigilance. If you were attacked in a dark alley, your brain digs a trench that says, rule number one, never walk in dark alleys. Rule number two, in fact, never go out at night. Rule number three, in fact, never trust strangers.
You are surviving. You aren't dead. You've successfully avoided the initial threat.
But your reachable future has shrunk from a beautiful 360-degree vista to a tiny, narrow slit of sky you can see from the bottom of the trench. You could only do this one thing. Be hyper-cautious. You have lost your optionality. You've lost your freedom.
So trauma isn't the wound. It's the scar tissue that restricts your movement forever after.
It's the loss of topological freedom. You are trapped in a survival loop that was adaptive then, but is maladaptive now. And this applies perfectly to institutions, too.
Oh, totally. As you were saying that, I was just thinking of bureaucracy.
Exactly. Bureaucracy is a form of institutional trauma. Usually a massive rigid bureaucracy forms because something went wrong when someone embezzled money or a critical mistake was made. So they built a rule, a process, to prevent that specific failure from ever happening again. They dug a trench.
And then something else went wrong, so they added another rule and another trench.
Until the entire organization can only do one thing. Follow the procedure manual. It can't innovate. It can't pivot when the market changes. It has survived past failures, but it's now essentially brain dead. It has zero reachable futures beyond what's written in the rule book.
So if trauma is a problem with the landscape, what is the self in this model? Is the self just the little marble rolling around in these trenches?
The text argues that the self is the viability organizer. It's the pilot of the ship.
The pilot.
It's the control architecture that constantly tries to steer the system away from the cliff edge, away from the boundary of dollars. And how does it do that? What are the instruments on its control panel?
Well, I guess logic. Reason, planning.
Sometimes. But its most immediate and powerful instruments, affect, emotion, feelings.
Feelings. We're usually told to ignore our feelings and be rational.
And this text says that's insane. It rebrands emotions as proximity sensors.
Oh, I like that. Proximity sensors.
Think about anxiety. What is anxiety, topologically?
A fear of what might happen in the future.
It's a radar ping. It's a sensor measuring the distance, let's call it dollars to the boundary. When you feel anxious, your internal pilot is shouting, hey, the margin is getting thin. We are getting closer to the cliff. Pay attention.
And what about depression then?
Depression is often a signal of entrenchment overload. The system is broadcasting a message. My backpack is too heavy. I have no surplus energy. I cannot climb these ridges. I need to shut down all non-essential functions to conserve dollars. It's a low power mode.
So treating our emotions as irrational or as nuisances to be suppressed is actually completely irrational. They are vital data streams.
They are highly precise topological data. If you ignore your anxiety, you're disabling your proximity alarm.
Yeah.
And that's usually when you drive straight off the cliff.
This frame, it really shifts how you see yourself, doesn't it? You aren't a broken person. You are a competent pilot navigating a dangerously deformed landscape.
Exactly. And that shift in perspective, that is the perfect bridge to section four, the unified philosophy.
The metaphysics, the big picture.
The metaphysics.
Okay, usually when we get to metaphysics, people's eyes glaze over. Is the table really real? Do I actually exist? It can feel like, you know, late night dorm room stoner talk. But the text claims this is intensely practical.
It argues that philosophy isn't a luxury for the idle. It's a core survival mechanism.
How so?
Well, let's look at the three big traditional questions of philosophy. Ontology, what is real? Epistemology, how do we know it's true?
Yeah.
And axiology, what is good or valuable?
Okay, the big three.
The text says, these aren't separate questions. These are just different parts of the same viability management process. Take epistemology, the question of truth. Why do we, as a species, care so much about truth?
Because, well, lying is bad. It's a moral issue.
But why is it bad? In this framework, the process of knowing is reframed as constraint forecasting. You're constantly building a mental map of the territory, of the landscape, and its boundaries.
Okay, I think I see where this is going.
If your map of the world says there is a solid bridge ahead, but in reality there is a 1,000-foot cliff, what happens when you act on that knowledge?
You drive right off the cliff.
You die. You cross the boundary of dollars. So truth isn't just some abstract philosophical virtue. Truth is the accuracy of your map relative to the actual location of the cliff edges. A false map, whether it's a government lying to its people, or a CEO lying to shareholders, or you lying to yourself about your drinking problem, is topologically destabilizing.
Lying is topologically destabilizing. That is such a heavy sentence. It means that deception isn't just naughty. In this framework, it's functionally lethal.
It creates a fatal gap between your calculated trajectory and your actual trajectory. And in that gap, collapse hides.
Which leads right into the third question. Ethics, axiology, what is good?
This might be my favorite part of the entire text. It proposes a scientific, non-sectarian basis for morality.
Okay, I'm listening. What is it?
Value is defined as preserving reachable futures.
Say that one more time for me.
An action is good if it expands or preserves the space where the future remains possible. What the text calls methkali del. An action is bad or evil if it narrows or closes that space.
So murder is bad because...
Because it reduces the victim's reachable future space to zero. That's the ultimate narrowing. Obviously.
But it also applies to something more subtle, like, say, a company dumping toxic waste into a river to save money.
Exactly. Dumping the waste saves money today. It increases the company's immediate flow and margin, but it prosens the aquifer for 100 years. It massively narrows the viable space for the entire community for generations. In this framework, it is a topologically evil act.
I love that. It doesn't rely on a specific holy book or a government's law code. It relies on the pure geometry of survival. The ultimate ethical question becomes, does this action close a door for myself or for others that cannot be reopened?
And if the answer is yes, it's an unethical action. This establishes survival not as the ultimate goal of life. We don't just want to survive, we want to flourish. But as the absolute precondition for everything else we value. You can't have justice, you can't have art, you can't have love if you have collapsed into non-existence.
So the primary moral imperative for any agent, a person, a company, a country is don't break the sandbox.
Don't break the sandbox. Preserve the possibility of tomorrow for everyone.
Which seems like a perfect, if slightly sobering, segue to the real world. Because let's be honest, we seem to be kind of breaking the sandbox in a few areas right now.
We are definitely testing the structural limits of our systems.
Let's talk about section five, real world applications. And let's start with medicine, because this framework completely changes how we should see health.
It absolutely does. Modern medicine is a miracle of acute care. If you fall off the cliff, if you have a heart attack, a traumatic injury, a severe infection, we are amazing at catching you. We are masters at pulling people back from the boundary of dollars.
We're great at the dramatic save.
We are the best in the world at it, but we are terrible at managing what we could call corridor width.
Corridor width, what do you mean?
Imagine your health is a hallway you are walking down. If the hallway is wide, you have a lot of room. You can sway a little, you can stumble, and you don't hit the wall. That's robust health. It's resilience. It's having a wide margin for error.
Okay, that makes sense.
Chronic disease, diabetes, hypertension, metabolic syndrome is the slow, insidious narrowing of that hallway. For a long time, you might feel fine. You might have no symptoms at all. but your corridor is now only inches wider than your shoulders. One salty meal, one night of bad sleep, one stressful day at work, and you slam into the wall.
So our medical system is designed to fix the damage after you hit the wall, but it does almost nothing to help you widen the corridor in the first place.
Precisely. We fix the margin with a pill, but we ignore the underlying entrenchment that narrowed the corridor. We treat the event, not the topology.
And burnout. This feels like the perfect model for burnout.
Burnout is the logical conclusion of the cult of optimization.
But optimization is supposed to be good. We're told to optimize everything.
In a simple machine, maybe? In a complex living system? No. Optimization almost always means removing redundancy, removing slack.
Cutting the fat, making it lean and mean.
But in systems theory, fat is just energy storage. Slack is geometric interiority. It's the buffer you absolutely need to absorb unexpected shocks. If you optimize your life so that every minute is productive, every dollar is invested, every calorie is perfectly counted, you have systematically stripped away all of your shock absorbers.
You become incredibly efficient, but also incredibly fragile.
You become a glass cannon. You're very powerful when things are predictable, but one unexpected hit shatters you completely.
This applies directly to economics too, doesn't it? The text really goes after our obsession with GDP.
It completely mauls the concept of GDP as a measure of well-being. Because GDP measures one thing and one thing only, flow. It measures the speed of the river of money, each GDP teaches.
Right. The classic example is if I get in a horrible car crash and have to spend months in the hospital, GDP goes way up. Ambulance fees, surgery costs, physical therapy, buying a new car, the money is flowing.
But has the viability of the system gone up? Of course not. You are hurt. Your car is wrecked. You have massive entrenchment now in the form of medical bills and trauma. The text argues that you can have a booming economy that is actually cannibalizing its own future to create that flow.
It's like eating the seed corn for next year's harvest.
Or burning your furniture to heat the house for one night. You can boost today's GDP by clear-cutting a forest, which creates ecological entrenchment. You can boost GDP by encouraging massive consumer and national debt, which creates financial entrenchment.
So we are celebrating the reading on the speedometer while the car's engine is actively melting down.
Precisely. We need a national viability index, not just a gross domestic product. An index that measures margin and entrenchment.
And debt itself. The text calls debt structural memory. I found that fascinating.
The debt is a time machine. It's a mechanism for pulling resources from the future into the present. And that's not inherently evil. Sometimes you need to do that to survive a crisis.
Like the business loan we talked about earlier to make payroll.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But if you never pay it back, if you just keep pulling more and more from the future to fund the present, eventually the future arrives and it's empty. You have hollowed out the timeline.
That is a chilling image, a hollowed out future. And this connects directly to the problem of inequality too.
Inequality is at its core a topological problem. We look at metrics like the average American household income or the average global citizen, but the average is a dangerous lie.
Because the landscape is folded and we're all in different valleys.
Yes. The wealthy live in a wide, flat, stable basin with huge horizons. They have so much margin that they can fail multiple times, they can waste money, they can get sick, and they stay safe.
And the poor.
They're living their lives trapped in deep, narrow overdraft basins at the edge of the cliff. One broken down car, one unexpected medical bill, one missed paycheck, and they fall off the map completely.
So when we say the economy is doing well, we are only looking at the aggregate flow. But underneath, the very structure of the landscape is fragmenting.
And you cannot build a stable civilization on top of millions of individual cascading collapses. Topologically, it won't hold. The instability from the bottom of the landscape eventually shakes the top.
Which brings us to the biggest boss of them all, governance. The government.
The self of civilization.
The text calls government the cross-scale integrator, which is a very fancy way of saying, what exactly?
Its job is to manage the coupling between all the different subsystems. The economy, the ecology, the health system, national security. These things aren't separate. They're all tied together like gears in a complex machine.
Okay, so it's the master coordinator.
Yes. And the primary danger of bad governance, according to this text, is a phenomenon called exported overdraft.
Exported overdraft.
This is the ultimate cheat code for politicians and CEOs. You make your system look healthy by secretly pushing your debt and your damage onto another system.
Give me an example of that.
You save the economy by deregulating pollution controls on factories. So corporate profits, their margin go up, The economy looks great. But the ecology, the entrenchment in our air and water gets destroyed. You simply shifted the overdraft from the bank ledger to the river.
Or you save a company's quarterly profits by burning out the workers, forcing them to work unpaid overtime.
Exactly. The company's balance sheet survives, but the workers' physical and mental health collapses. You exported the debt from the financial system into the biological systems of your employees.
But the text argues, there is no away. You can't really throw things away.
There is no away. We live in a closed system. The Earth, our viable set dollars, is finite. Eventually, the feedback loop closes. If you poison the river, the workers who drink the water get sick, they can't work, and the economy crashes anyway. You can delay the check, but you can never, ever cancel it.
Global viability contraction.
That's the endgame of decades of exported overdraft. The whole sandbox, the whole island we live on, gets smaller for everyone.
In trust. I want to touch on trust before we wrap up. Because usually people think of trust as this soft, fuzzy, let's all hold hands kind of concept. But the text treats it like a law of physics.
Trust is a coefficient of friction.
Explain that.
Okay, imagine you want to do something big in society. Build a bridge, pass a law, launch a new product. That takes a certain amount of energy.
Yeah.
Now, add low trust to that environment.
People sue you. Protesters block the construction site. Investors get scared and pull their funding. Employees leak secrets to the press. Everyone is suspicious.
That is friction. All of that is disturbance. Low trust drastically increases the energy cost of everything. You have to fight against the system itself just to get anything done.
So a high trust society is?
Yeah.
It's just more aerodynamic.
Yes. That's a great way to put it. High trust lowers the baseline cost of existence. You don't need as many lawyers, as many security guards, as many complicated contracts, as many police. You can do more with less energy.
So political legitimacy isn't just a popularity contest. It's a thermodynamic efficiency metric. A government that nobody trusts is dangerously inefficient.
And dangerously unstable. Because when friction is high, the wobble before a collapse gets much, much worse. The curves get steeper.
Man, we have covered everything. From the mitochondria in a single cell to the global stock market to the metaphysics of truth itself.
It's a unifying grammar, like the title says. It connects the dots across all those scales.
It really does. So let's bring it all home. We've done the deep dive, now we need to surface. For the listener, what do we do with all of this?
We have to go back to the golden rule.
The golden rule of viability.
The central evaluative question. Whether you are looking at your own life, your family's budget, your business strategy, or your ballot paper in an election, you have to ask this one single question. Does this action widen or narrow the space in which the future remains possible?
Not, is it profitable in the next quarter? Not, is it popular right now?
But does it keep the game going for as many people as possible for as long as possible? Does it add options or does it permanently remove them?
And for the listeners who are hearing this and feeling entrenched, who are listening to this and thinking, my backpack is huge. My corridor is terrifyingly narrow. I'm stuck in a deep basin. What's the message for them?
For them, the message is about healing.
And remembering that healing isn't free. It requires surplus.
That is the single most important practical takeaway. You cannot heal by barely scraping by. You cannot fix a collapsing bridge while traffic is still jamming over it at 100 miles per hour.
You have to close a lane. You have to slow things down.
You have to close a lane. You have to slow the flow. You need to generate a budget surplus of money, yes, but also of time, of energy, of attention, and you must invest that surplus back into fixing the structure.
You have to use your surplus to pay down the cost of your history.
You have to remodel the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes time, and it takes slack. So the final thought is, don't apologize for needing rest. Don't apologize for needing unproductive time. That isn't laziness. That is you actively widening your corridor. It's the most important work you can do.
Reserve your margin. Watch your topology.
That's the mantra.
The source for today's deep dive was The Unifying Grammar of Viability by Dr. Bichara Saheeli. It's a heavy text, but I think it might be one of the most important ones we've ever covered.
I agree. It changes how you see the cliff edges all around us.
Well, I'm going to go generate some surplus. I think that might just mean taking a nap.
That is a highly viable strategy.
Thanks for listening to this deep dive. Take care of your reachable futures, everyone. We'll see you next time.